So this is the fourth class in the series on the masters. This is Lakshmi speaking about Sri Yukteswar.
We were just talking about Guru Day a few years ago and talking about Sri Yukteswar. And I did. I fell in love with him that day, or throughout the process of reading about him and getting to know him a little bit more. And this is where I keep coming back to him. And I feel so struck by the bhakti that's hidden underneath all of these shrouds of discipline and sternness and strict discipleship. And I was thinking a lot about, I guess let me back up and start before we get there. I've really been touched as we've gone through each week with the masters, and it struck me this weekend. I had a lot of time to read and just sit with the gurus and reflect back on all of the classes that we've had thus far, and it struck me so profoundly the intensity of their love, and the intensity of the love that we feel for them and that they offer back to us, and how tangible it is. And you can really feel that in the course of this reading here. Chapter 12 is what I'll be referencing most, Years of My Master's Hermitage. And you can feel just how visceral that connection is in the way that the masters relate to all of us. I was thinking about, we started with Christ, and one of my favorite stories with Christ is Peter, after Peter denies him three times, and when Christ is resurrected three times, he says, "Do you love me?" And Peter says, "Yes." "Do you love me?" "Yes." "Do you love me?" "Yes." And then Babaji, we have this example of, you know, I have a connection to Babaji personally, because the first time that I was reading the AY, when I read the chapter about Babaji and read that he is the eternal saint in the Himalayan mountains protecting us and loving us, I called my sister. And I said, this path is incredible, and these masters are incredible. And I said, listen to this story. And I said, he's just there, loving us, waiting us, protecting us. And we were raised Catholic, and we were raised in a beautiful way with Catholicism, which is that the stories that we hear in the Bible are myths, and they're there to help us learn how to go deeper within ourselves. So that's the culture of my family. So my sister said, yeah, that's a beautiful story. You know, again, just relating to it the same way we would some of the stories we grew up with. And I said, no, but it's true. He's there. And we had a nice little exchange, and she said, okay, but that was the moment I knew this was my path, and that these gurus were mine, because I knew he was there, and I didn't know how I knew, but I knew it was true, and I knew there was nothing that could talk me out of that or deny that. I missed last week with Lahiri, but just thinking about, we're talking a little bit about and reflecting on the intensity of love that each of the masters offers to us, and how when we can open up to that and just accept it, we're given opportunities to find infinity. With Lahiriji, just that reality, I just always reflect and think about that moment when he was with Babaji, and Babaji gave him the opportunity to pass Kriya on to those who were very sincere, and he said, oh, but there are so many who want Kriya, and Babaji said, then it shall be so. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. And as a result of that, we're given the opportunity to have Kriya. And so step by step, we're given these intense examples of just how genuine and true and real the Master's love is for us. And as I was reading about Sri Yukteswar this week, I just had this sense and this knowing that all of the miracles and all of the exchanges that happened between Yogananda and Sri Yukteswar throughout the course of the AY and some of the other stories that we have, or little books that we have, which I'll reference here, those stories and those miracles are ours. And I was talking with a friend a little bit earlier, and she was relaying all of these miracles that she's witnessed in her life, and I had this feeling as I was listening to her speaking and thinking, I don't have any examples of that, of miracles, of watching people, go in a state of samadhi, or just seeing really tangible, profound examples of miracles in my life. That's not mine yet. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that means. I wonder what I do with that. And as I was sitting there listening to this person speak about them, I realized that those are my miracles, because even if I wasn't there to witness them, the fact that I have this relationship with someone who's teaching me through them, who's showing us that relationship to the divine and how it's real and it's visceral to us, that those are ours and we get to share them as well. And that's what I felt throughout the course of reading this, with each of those examples, that we get to own these miracles along with the masters, and it just creates such a closeness and such a beauty with them. And so that brings me back to what we were referencing two years ago now. For Guru Day, I had the opportunity to speak on Sri Yukteswar, and that's when I fell in love with him a little bit. And one of the things that I love, Mortis, I love, I think I'm a bhakti. I didn't know I was a bhakti, and now I'm realizing I'm a bhakti. And I love just cuddling and adorning them. And I was also, along with speaking that day, I was also responsible for decorating the shrine. So a few days before, after I was reading and studying and trying to get everything in line and saying, what would I say? I just went outside and gave Sri Yukteswar a bath. This is the Murti that's in the shrine in the community, just to clean him up and get him ready for Guru Day. And we were just sitting out on the grass, and I had water and cloths and just washing his feet and getting all the little critters out of each of the nooks and crannies. And I just had, that's the moment that I fell in love with him, because I was just talking to him, and, you know, we weren't even talking about the talk, we were just having a conversation. And this jovial laugh that is referenced so many times in the AY, you could just feel it. He was having so much fun just having a bath and just and talking and just being informal. It reminded me of the story. There's a story in the AY where Sri Yukteswar meets, this is the moment that Sri Yukteswar was offered the title of Swami and was commissioned by Babaji to write what is now the Holy Science, but to write a book that merged East and West, the teachings of East and West. And when he was there, he didn't know that he was talking to Babaji, because Babaji had cloaked that aspect of himself in order to allow Sri Yukteswar to feel free and comfortable. That's what the story says in the AY, so that he didn't have to feel tense and excited. And we all know what happens, hopefully, if we don't, we'll know soon. The second time he meets Babaji, and he does know it's Babaji.
Yeah. Before we lose that thought, mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite memories of the Guru Day. I just have to share it. Because I was also there, and I was working with Navaditi on the Jesus Shrine. And I see Lakshmi, and she picks up Sri Yukteswar, and she just walks over. There's like that faucet in front of like Nivashan's place, I think it is. You know, mm-hmm. It was around there. I'm going to pick up Jesus' time because it's like solid marble. How did she do that? I didn't realize. I was like, how did she do that? Walking over.
That's a great story. I never heard that. Sri Yukteswar is made of plaster. Not marble. Oh, my fun. Magic. It felt like such a personal moment with Sri Yukteswar, where I could feel just that exchange of love, because instead of being in my head about what I was going to say, and this was one of the first times that I was speaking at Ananda, so I felt all of these, the butterflies and the natural anxiety around it, and just giving him a bath outside and talking to him, it was the same experience. It's just that it was that cloak of there's nothing to be afraid of here. There's nothing beyond just your heart and my heart and this exchange of love, and just being present in the center of that. And so it always reminds me of that story that Sri Yukteswar has when Babaji cloaks him so that he doesn't have to feel that anxiety and he can really rest. And it's a profound moment for him. Babaji, who is disguised, calls him Swamiji, or calls him a Swami, and he says, I'm not a Swami. And Babaji's response, just cloaked as a sadhu, is, When I give the name Swami, the title Swami, to someone, it comes from God, and they always accept it. And Sri Yukteswar said, okay. And then beyond men, he was commissioned to write a book and said, I don't know if I can write this book. And again, Babaji said, if I'm giving this commission, then it should be so. And he went on to write it and goes home to his master, Lahiri, and tells him about the story. And Lahiri says, that was Babaji. And he says, oh my gosh. He gets all flustered and gets right to work on the book. And that's another interesting fact. I'll start moving chronologically. But the Holy Science, the original draft that he wrote, I don't know if you guys know this, was that he wrote it in French. He wanted to go and study in France. I learned that in, this is an amazing little book that came to me through different circumstances, but it's a tiny little biography of Sri Yukteswar, and it had stories I'd never heard before. And so he wrote the original manuscript in French because he wanted to participate in, I'm going to call it a symposium, but I don't know what it would have been called then, in France. And so he wrote it and sent it off to a monastic that he knew in the Christian monastery in France. And that when the monastic read it, he said, oh, the Christian world is not ready for this, and somehow lost the manuscript, so they don't have the original manuscript. Then he rewrote it, and this time wrote it in English, and it became what is now the Holy Science. So that's an interesting fact. He spoke Bengali, French, Hindi, English, and some Sanskrit. So he didn't get proficient in Sanskrit, but I'm sure he was. So if we back up a little bit now and just start talking about Sri Yukteswar, I wrote some themes up on the board behind me just to reference a little bit. These were some of the major themes that I saw in the stories that we'll share, and just some of the threads, if we can take the incarnation that was Sri Yukteswar and condense it down in various forms. I found this balance between them, which is sort of the superficial aspect and then the deeper aspect to each of them, and so there's a pull within each one. But obviously the gyanic path, reason, logic, knowledge, these were things that dictated a lot of the teachings that Sri Yukteswar offered to Yogananda and his other disciples. But the link between that is the deeper wisdom, and the wisdom that brings us back to the heart and to the oneness with God. And I realized, I shouldn't say I realized, what I feel as I was reading about Sri Yukteswar and the gyanic aspect. Again, I don't buy that he's just a gyana yogi. I know it's there, and I know that it's the proclivity that he was born with. He's extremely intelligent, and we'll go through some of his history and his education there. But knowledge was a core aspect in his life and his personality, and so the gyana aspect is there. But what I was feeling as I was reading this week is that path of wisdom for Yogananda, who's a bhakti, who's crying out for Divine Mother, who's writing these words in Whispers from Eternity, this poetry that's just pouring from his heart, that's the bhakti path to God. And the jnana path to God is, in fact, the discipline. That's why I linked discipline and devotion. So what we feel is that sternness, that harshness, all of which was present for Sri Yukteswar. What I just kept feeling is that for the jnani is the path to God, because through our discipline, through our techniques, through the understanding of knowledge, and Sri Yukteswar has a beautiful line in the AY when he's talking about reading, and he says, you can't understand something with the eyes, you have to understand it with the atoms. Meaning that it has to be inside of you. You have to feel it from within in order to own it as knowledge. And this is true jnana yoga. And the way that we get there is steadfast determination and discipline. The jnana yogi shows up every day on his pillow, working through the techniques with steadfast determination, because attaining that wisdom, knowing that from the inside out, is in fact knowing God. And God is love. Therefore, he can say at the end of the Holy Science, thus I've shown that everything in this book brings us back to devotion. Because devotion and discipline And again, I don't presume to know what Teshua actually meant or was feeling, but that's what I kept feeling as I was reading through it, that there's a connection there. So this discipline was actually, in my mind, linked to devotion, and we'll see that in some of the stories. Balance and equanimity. Swami Sri Teshwar is described by Yogananda as having his feet firmly rooted in the earth, but his heart in the haven of heaven. And we see that there is a balance between the duties and the obligations of the day, of the day-to-day work, and holding on to the hermitage and all of the things that he needed to do in order to keep the business going day-to-day. And he did not shy away from the material world. He worked with the material world and applied that to a higher consciousness. And that's what he taught his disciples to do as well. So this balance, this equilibrium, not shying away from or hiding or condemning that which is material or that which is grosser in consciousness, but working with it, working through it in order to elevate it to that higher aspect. So that equilibrium and that balance brings impartiality, brings detachment, brings the ability to walk through life like Hanuman, this weekend was referencing Hanuman being the quintessential disciple. That anything that comes at Hanuman, he just accepts. He's the open-hearted disciple. And so it gives us that opportunity to not feel at odds with anything in the world. The more that we can stay balanced in that and use the laws and the applications of the natural laws within the world and the natural laws within the spiritual energetic world and applying them together. And again, I'll share stories about all of this in ways that Keshwar does that. And then the last one, humility. Humility and surrender. And so those two are an obvious match. Sri Keshwar is the pillar of humility and an example of that. One of the favorite stories, and I might actually pull this quote if I can find it, when I was reading the chapter 11, when Yogananda meets Sri Keshwar for the first time, Sri Keshwar asks, "Will you give me your unconditional love?" And in response to that, Yogananda says yes. And Sri Teshwar goes on to say, "Ordinary love is selfish, darkly rooted in desires and satisfactions. Divine love is without condition, without boundary, without change. The flux of the human heart is gone forever at the transfixing touch of pure love." That we've heard often, but this part really struck me. He added humbly, "If ever you find me falling from a state of God-realization, please promise to put my head in your lap and help bring me back to the cosmic beloved we both worship." So this is in the first meeting with Yogananda. And that image, I saw Shanti this morning. I was in class in the middle of teaching, but I wasn't physically in the middle of teaching. And I was reading that at my computer, and I actually teared up a little bit because that image of Sri Teshwar looking at Yogananda, who is Mukunda, who's a young, boy for the most part, a teenage boy at this time, saying, "Put my head in your lap." It was such a humbling moment. And Yukteswar, in so many of the phrases and the teachings that he offers us, I was also telling Shanti, she was here, we were here together a little bit beforehand, it's taking everything in me not to just pick up and start reading chapter 5. Sri Teshwar can say it so much better than I can. But, and we may resort to that at the end, we'll see. Just kidding. But just that image of Sri Teshwar and the humility with that. Sri Teshwar was always aware that Maya existed in the world. He never took it for granted, and in every moment, he was just as cautious as everybody around him and in making sure that he was never at odds, that he wasn't falling into the traps of Maya. And that it's an important lesson for all of us, because we can kind of get on a path and just start cruising and say, "Wow, I'm making great progress. Look at everything I'm doing." And there Maya is just waiting to slip in. And so that idea, it made me think of the community that we have here in Ananda, and how that's what we rely on our brothers and sisters to do, that true unconditional love is bringing us back to that place. If ever you see me... if ever you find me falling from a state of God realization, please promise to put my head on your lap. And just realizing that that's the essence of community, and that's what we're here to do for each other, to hold up the mirror to one another and comfort each other and love each other and bring ourselves back to the one thing that is important in life, which is God realization, which is bringing ourselves back and releasing the ego. So that's just a bit of an introduction. Now we can actually talk about Sri Yukteswar. So Sri Yukteswar, very briefly in terms of biography, he was born in Serampore and lived there his whole life. That's where his ashram still is. He was born into a wealthy middle-class family. His father was a business owner, and his father owned the property that became the ashram that is still in existence today. And he was a householder early on in life, which is something that's interesting. He had a wife and a daughter, and his daughter had a granddaughter. But the way that he puts it, God allowed him to be monastic, and his wife died very early on after having their daughter, and his daughter passed away very young. He did have a daughter, but the daughter was married. This is what the little book says. The daughter was married, and so traditionally she kind of left and went off with her husband's family. So he was freed to live out the rest of his life as a monastic. And that's the point where he met Lahiri Mahashaya. It's a brief timeline. He met Lahiri in 1884 and was initiated into Kriya Yoga, and 10 years later is when he was commissioned by Babaji to write the Holy Science and was given the title of Swami. And so he lived the latter part of his life really as a monastic, training young disciples. And Lahiri and Babaji told him that Babaji told him he would send him a disciple, and Yogananda came to him in 1910. So within a 25-year span of time, he had met his guru and then was beginning to train, had reached realization or discovered realization within himself, and then was training Yogananda at that point, which is where, of course, the AY picks up within us. And then he passed away in 1930. I think that's all I want to say about his background or his history, unless there are questions. There isn't a lot in terms of, details the way that we would have them, not even really in terms of the way that we have details about Christ's life. And this book is very sweet, this little biography. It's not written by a disciple who's in our line. He's not a disciple of Yogananda, but he was a disciple of Sri Yukteswar. And the first lines are very sweet. He says, no one can ever endeavor to take on a biography of a great saint, but I've been commissioned with the task, so I'll do my best. And when I read that, I thought, ah, this is a biography I want to read. And then he goes on to tell sweet little stories. And so Sri Yukteswar in his early life was extremely interested in gaining knowledge and attaining knowledge. He studied everything. He studied art, music, martial arts. He studied anatomy. He studied medicine. He was, after his, I don't know what it would be in India, but his elementary training and his, what would be the equivalent of middle school and high school, I don't know what it would be then, he went on to Bible school, and he spent just under 2 years in a biblical school, in a Christian school, and this is where he discovered and started learning about Christ, and he fell in love with Christ and was really moved by the relationship that Christ had with these teachings and feeling the essence of the yogic philosophy that was flowing through Christ. And that really began what became his ultimate commission to write the Holy Science and to train Yogananda, who would bring together East and West. So that's a significant period of time. But alas, he got bored, because as most highly intelligent people, we see this trend a lot. As most highly intelligent people, he wasn't finding fulfillment there. And he was really interested in the anatomy of the body. So he went on and he went to medical school for 2 years. But he did not finish medical school either. But there he learned a lot more about the body and really began to use it and to apply the yogic teachings. So then he started studying mudra and pranayama and asana. And so really using that knowledge of the physical anatomy of the body and applying it to dhyana yoga, to that relationship. And if you've read, has anyone tackled the Holy Science? Yeah, a little bit. If you read even just a couple pages, I was telling Shanti this weekend, I was reading it and I said, I almost dare to say I think I'm beginning to understand it, but I'm not. You know, I have this.
She was afraid to say that.
I know. Especially after reading the quote that I read after that, which is that your eyes, you can't attain knowledge with the eyes. You have to feel it with the atoms. Then I'm definitely not understanding it yet. But I have this relationship with this book, and I don't know if other people have this. While I'm reading it, I feel like I understand it perfectly. It's like a dream. But then as soon as he puts it down, it's gone. So it's just attunement with the vibration. But in it, the words are expressing a lot about the intricacies of the body and the relationship and the way that energy is moving through the body. So he was applying this knowledge of anatomy to that and working through it in that way. And so a few fun stories. When he was a child, when he was a teenager, he befriended a family. They were the Goswami family, and they were a highly recognized and family in the community, and they had a Sanskrit teacher. So he went and he was learning Sanskrit along with the children in the Goswami family. And he realized that the Sanskrit teacher was simply repeating scripture, but he didn't know, and this is the time we see this a lot, he did that the Sanskrit teacher didn't actually know or understand the scripture. So so Sri Yukteswar started writing his own scriptures and bringing them in, and then finally got caught and ran away. But just trying to play with this idea from a very young age, it was clear, and this is a trend we see with all of our gurus, that the experience of God is what matters. Knowledge means nothing if we don't have the experience behind it, the tangible application of knowing and feeling that. And from a very young age, Sri Yukteswar knew this and practiced it. He also, when he was young, heard of a saint in the community who could levitate and was rumored to spend all night levitating. So he snuck into the saint's room and hid under his bed, and in the middle of the night popped out when the saint was not levitating and scolded him and ran away as well. That's what the book says. I don't know what he really did, but the books keep saying that he ran away. We can just see, you know, it's this trend all the way back to Krishna, this air of mischievousness as a child, but really it's all playing with God. We have so many stories of Mukunda as a child playing with God in that way and playing in that relationship with the sincerity underneath it. It was so true and so pure in what he was seeking, and that's what ultimately leads him on the journey to find his guru and move on to become everything that he was. So as he matured in his relationship with these teachings, he began, and with yogic teachings, he began to look at, and this brings us to the balance and equanimity, he began to look at the relationship between them. He was always comparing, looking at the relationship between science and religion, reason and faith, efficiency and spirituality. So there was I think this is one of the reasons that I love him so much. There was a groundedness in everything that he did. He worked with the material world. There's a story in here that talks about his disciples, and one of his disciples, he never, he never forbid his disciples from seeing doctors, and he would talk to them and he would tell them that doctors are working with healing on the material plane in the best way that they know how, and that because we are on that material plane, we also have to work with healing in that way. Then he goes on to talk about how we have to affirm that you never affirm that you are this material body, and that you have the power to heal yourself by thought and by reason, and that prana, that life force, is the true healer. And he goes on to say that life force and prana is the true cleansing, cleanser of the body. And this is an experience, this is a lesson that he learned firsthand for himself. So when he was a young boy with Sri Yukteswar, a man with Lahiri Mahashaya, and he was being trained, one day he came to Lahiri, and he was extremely sick, and he had lost a lot of weight, and he was feeling, and he said to his guru, I don't feel well, I don't know what's wrong, and his guru said, I think that tomorrow you'll feel much better. He went home the next day, and he felt much better. He felt fine. He came back to his guru and bowed at his feet and said, "Thank you for healing me." And Lahiri hinted at, but didn't quite say yet, that it wasn't him. It wasn't Lahiri who healed him, but actually his own mind. But instead, Lahiri played with him a little bit and said, "Well, you feel better today, but I wonder what tomorrow will bring." And he comes back the next day, sick again, having lost all of the weight again, and just crawling to his guru, saying, "Help me." And that's when Lahiri says to him that you have to affirm that you are well, and that the moment you think you are well, you then nothing on this material plane can touch you. And he affirms that he's well, and in a matter of moments, he had gained 50 pounds, and his entire body changed. He walked home, he went home, and after meditating at his guru's feet, and his mother said, "What happened to you? Are you swelling?" And he says, "No." And from that moment on, he says he gained the 50 pounds, and he never lost them again. And so that was the power of the mind in an early lesson, and also one that Yogananda had to learn as well. We see a similar story with Yogananda and Sri Keshwar in that sense. And so that's one of the founding principles that he lives by. Again, it merges logic, reason, wisdom with logic, reason, and knowledge with wisdom. That idea that just because we live on the material plane doesn't mean that we have to exist in the material plane alone, that we can use I'm going to stand. It's a little easier to stand than it is to sit. And so the line that it says here, so the laws of the subtle levels of consciousness rule the physical world. And if we think we are well, we are well. This is the lesson that he teaches us here. And so again, this combines the discipline, the connection of discipline and devotion, because when we are adhering to the principles of yogic teachings, when we are living in that reality and that knowing that we are something beyond just this physical body, that there is a subtle universe that's working with us, this is what he goes on to say. There are subtle laws ruling the realms of consciousness which can be known only through the inner science of yoga. That the laws that we see and that we think exist are just the superficial veil, and that underneath that there's a law that is much truer and much realer, and this is the causal world. We have the material world, and then we have the causal energies that exist underneath that. And this is what Sri Keshwar was really working with throughout most of his life, and what he was teaching Yogananda to work with as well, to live and exist in those subtler realms. A little bit, not moving chronologically. Is that okay for everybody if we don't move chronologically? He's just pulling stories as they were coming out. I think I do want to try and move a little bit, at least with it. So another story is the materialization and dematerialization of Sri Yukteswar. So this is in the autobiography of the yogi as well. And Sri Yukteswar was away in Calcutta on business. And Yogananda and his fellow companion at the ashram in Dijon they got a message from Sri Yukteswar that he was going to come home on the 9 o'clock train. And so the message said, and this was a telegram, said to come and meet him at the 9 o'clock train. And as Yogananda was meditating, he got a message from Sri Yukteswar that that he was delayed, that his business was taking longer than it needed to, and that he would be coming at a later train, so not to meet him. Of course, Mukunda at this time goes and tells his friend, and his friend doesn't believe him and says, "No, I'm going to go to the train station anyway." Goes and waits for the 9 o'clock train. Sri Yukteswar doesn't show up. Waits for the 9:30 train. Sri Yukteswar doesn't show up. And in the meantime, as Mukunda is meditating, Sri Yukteswar materializes to him, and he describes in the AY how he could feel his feet and feel the wind from his robe and the touch of the robe. So that, again, relating to the reality that it wasn't a hallucination, that he was actually physically there with Sri Yukteswar, with Mukunda in the room. And he says to Mukunda, "My business is finished. I'll be arriving on the 10 o'clock train." And so on his way, Dijin, his friend, has in the meantime returned, and Mukunda says, he's arriving on the 10 o'clock train, let's go and greet him. And Dijin is, of course, a little bit sad and discouraged when Sri Teshwar is there and says to him, I sent you a message too, but you didn't receive it. And Dijin turns to Yogananda and says, what did you do? You blocked the message from Sri Teshwar. And of course, Mukunda says, how could I have blocked it? It was simply your heart's restlessness. So again, we're seeing these scenes coming up, just like Babaji says to Sri Teshwar. We never finished that story. But the second time that Sri Teshwar is greeted by Babaji, he shows up. Babaji says that he'll come as soon as Sri Teshwar finishes the holy science. And so he goes to the bathhouse one morning. I know I'm jumping around. He goes to the bathhouse one morning on the Ganges, and there's Babaji and his tribe with a few of his friends. And Sri Teshwar is so excited, and he says, will you come home? And will you come to my house so I can host you? And Babaji says, no, we're much more suited for the shade of the trees. I love that line. And he says, okay, well, wait one moment. And he goes home to get some treats and comes back, and Babaji is gone. And so he's sad, and he's hurt by this. And I think about how true that is and how I would probably act the exact same way, and it hurts my heart to think about it. And I would probably be sad and annoyed. So then later, Sri Teshwar is with his guru, and Lahiri says, look in the corner, and there's Babaji waiting. And Sri Teshwar snubs him. He doesn't bow, he doesn't do anything, he just looks at him and kind of walks away. And Lahiri says, what are you doing? I'm paraphrasing all of this. They were much more eloquent. But and he says, what are you doing? And Babaji says, you're annoyed with me, aren't you? And he says, yes. And he says, you disappeared. I asked you to wait, and you disappeared from you disappeared on me the last time. And his line is, I was fairly extinguished in the ether from your restlessness. And then, of course, he bows at Babaji's feet, and they're reconciled again. But that's a common trend that we see, because it's the same thing that Mukunda says to Dijin in this moment, where he says, you couldn't hear the message because of your heart's restlessness. So again, just bringing us back to these themes and these trends along the way, that when we can work with that subtle energy and slow down the constant spinning of the mind and really feel from within, again, the teaching that that Sri Teshwar gives us, not to feel with our eyes or our minds, but to know from within, to truly understand. And then the restlessness of the heart and the soul is calm. And so in this moment, Dijin asks how Yogananda knew that he was coming on the train. He tells him the whole story and how he had materialized for him and told him when he would be coming and what he would look like. And Dijin's response is so beautiful. He says they were on their way. They were journeying to Visirampur College at this time, I believe, or a university, if not that one in Calcutta, when they were speaking and telling the story. And Dijin looks around him and he says, I have a feeling that the knowledge that our guru can impart on us makes any university or any college campus in the world, the teachings of any college campus, look like kindergarten. And so it just brought back that idea, because wisdom and knowledge and reason and intellect are such an important trend in Sri Teshwar's life, it's important to note that he was very clear and very stern in what that knowledge actually meant. And so this line, even though it didn't involve Sri Teshwar directly in that line, that moment that Dijin can say, it makes this college campus and our guru has the ability to make these teachings, this college campus look like kindergarten. It's that reality that that's where we all are. We're in these beginning stages of really truly knowing and understanding with the depth and the wisdom that Sri Teshwar was imparting to us. The true jnana is so much deeper than just knowledge. We do have to study. That is one thing that he says to Sri Teshwar one time when they were he was meditating. We all know the story well. And he scolds Yogananda for not meditating clearly, for not being concentrated. And Mukunda says, I haven't stirred, I haven't moved. And he says, I know how you are meditating. And he goes on to talk about how in the back of his mind he was planning, he was creating three different locations, three buildings, one on a hilltop, one on a seaside, one on the plain. And these became Ranchi School, the school, the building on the plain, Mount Washington on the hilltop, and the Antonides Hermitage on the ocean. And Yogananda in the AY describes how in the back of his mind, unconsciously, they were there. These three buildings were there. And why did I say this? We were talking about wisdom and knowing. And I can repeat everything that you said. And so in that moment, he talks about how he can see into the mind and the soul of the mind of Yogananda, and how Yogananda has offered him that opportunity. I can't remember what it was. So we'll put a pin in that one and come back to it. I was telling a story for a reason.
The leaves, he was thinking you're meditating, but your mind's like leaves in the wind.
Yes, he's meditating like leaves in the wind. Yeah, that's a great one. And then there are so many quotes that we have that we hear so often that are actually Keshwar's quotes, and these teachings are so rich and deep. I thought that this was really interesting. So Richard Wright came to, he came with Yogananda. So when Yogananda returned to India in 1935, he brought Richard Wright with him. And Richard Wright describes, he has two letters, in one of them he describes his first meeting with Sri Keshwar. And he really focuses on and emphasizes the simplicity and the humility with which Sri Keshwar carried himself. In two lines that he says, I observed that this rather dilapidated room suggested the owner's non-attachment to material comforts. And then he goes on to say, at one end of the room hung a picture of Lahiri, garlanded in simple devotion. And we talked a little bit about, or we referenced humility a bit. And in terms of Sri Keshwar, and I think that this is such an important example that Sri Keshwar offers to us. There's a line when Yogananda is referring to the mosquitoes. There are two stories about mosquitoes, and they're both infamous with Sri Keshwar. The second one, which we reference less, the one that we reference the most is when Yogananda is meditating and a mosquito lands on him and he goes to slap it, but then he remembers Ahimsa and chooses not to, and Sri Keshwar says, why don't you just finish the job? And goes on to talk about that the desire, as soon as that moment and the desire is there, the deed is done. The death blow has been issued. That's what he says. The first story, it actually comes first, that is referenced less, is one in which when Yogananda was living at home, they always slept with mosquito nets. And then he comes to the Sirampara ashram, and they're not sleeping with mosquito nets anymore, and he's getting bitten to pieces. And one night, he's sending messages to his guru of pain and angst and all of the bites and the scratches that he has, and Yukteswar says to him, why don't you go and buy a mosquito net, and but don't just buy one for yourself, buy one for me as well, or else all the mosquitoes are going to eat just me. And so then for the next few nights, every night Sri Yukteswar sends him up to prepare the mosquito nets. One night they're meditating, and Sri Yukteswar doesn't say anything to him. And he's kind of sitting there, Mukunda's waiting, kind of peeking over, looking, saying, okay, what do we do now? It's getting later in the evening, it's time for bed. And he goes over to his guru, and his guru isn't breathing. He isn't moving, he has no pulse, so he's in samadhi. And this is the first experience that Yogananda has had with this, and it's very sweet. He holds a mirror under Yogananda's nose and to see if there's any breath, and there isn't any breath. And then he plugs his nose in his mouth to see if there's any breath, and there's nothing happening. And it's just so sweet to imagine little Mukunda, our Yogananda, just up there holding his guru's mouth and nose. And just when he's about to run to go and get help, Sri Yukteswar laughs and says, well, a budding experimentalist, I see. And he says, why don't you go to bed? And Yogananda, without having to say it, because Sri Yukteswar is in his thoughts, he says, why don't you go to bed? Do you expect the world to change for you? And this is where these stories are so sweet, and then in a moment they become so profound. He says, do you expect the world to change for you? Rid yourself of mosquito consciousness. And Yogananda goes to bed that night and is never bit by the mosquitoes again. And it's just that realization, the world is always going to bombard us with whatever karmic lessons we have to learn, or whatever group karma is surrounding us. And if we are not bringing ourselves into that consciousness and rising up above it, then we're getting lost in the midst of that. I was just thinking about that. Shachi knows this. I have a fear of ticks. And I don't like them. I don't like thinking about them. My friend Jayeshwari, some of you may know her from the village, was here last week and was out in Half Moon Bay, and she has a dog. So we were talking about ticks because the dog got a lot of ticks out there. And I was thinking about this, and just that it was so striking. Rid yourself of mosquito consciousness. And I just thought, that's exactly what we have to do. Because ticks, Yogananda says to us, are negative energy, negative thoughts and negative energy from other universes, other planets that are sent here, and they're manifesting here, so they're actually just negative energy. So all we have to do is raise our own consciousness, raise our own energy, and create positive vibes, and then how can the ticks be harmful? Because when we are bigger, where there is light, darkness cannot exist. And so it's just there's a few things that triggered kind of personal stories for me in the midst of that. But in this moment, rid yourself of mosquito consciousness and I should keep telling these personal stories and then I'm losing my points. Personal stories sometimes do that. I guess we'll just move on. Maybe we'll go about 10 more minutes and then we'll take a little break. How does that sound? So one more story about wisdom and these first two that we're looking at, logic, reason, wisdom, and balance and equanimity. Again, these are all stories that we know, but it's just fun to share with them together. So the story of the cauliflower robbery. We all know this story. Yogananda has 6 prized cauliflower that he has hidden under his bed, and he was saving them to create a meal for for Sri Yukteswar. They're going out for a walk, and Sri Yukteswar asks him, did you lock the back door? And Yogananda goes, yeah, I think I did. And he stops for a moment and says, nope, you did not, and brings him back, and we all know the story, so I'll just paraphrase it, and has poor Yogananda watch as, a hungry thief who's itching for a cauliflower sneaks into the ashram through the unlocked back door, steals nothing but the cauliflower, and walks out happily. And there were 2 things that struck me in this story. And the first one is the way that Yogananda describes Sri Yukteswar's laugh as he's watching crazed, not crazy and malicious, but just sort of crazy. He's acting erratic. That's a better word. This erratic cauliflower thief come in and steal this cauliflower, and poor Yogananda is just dumbstruck by it. And just that reality, the joy that Yogananda, that Sri Yukteswar feels. It reminds me a lot of that story of the sadhu. I don't remember the context particularly or perfectly, but the sadhu who was walking through town, and the young children were throwing stones at him, and he's just laughing and laughing as the children are doing this, and he goes home and he's bloodied and bruised by the stones. And his disciples say, oh, what happened? What happened to you? And he says, oh, the children and I were playing. And he just, because he feels just joy in every moment, that everything is God, everything is a part of God. And when you're in that consciousness, it's just, everything is joyful. And in this moment, that laugh, I don't know why, because there's nothing malicious in what Sri Yukteswar is doing, even though he's saying, you must be punished, I'll teach you a lesson now. The joy that he's feeling in that because it's the joy of bringing us closer to God. Each one of these, you know, pain is fleeting. That's another line that he says to us. Material pain is fleeting, but wisdom is forever. And so it's this moment as he's laughing, and we can just hear that joy. It's not about anything other than the fact that he knows he's bringing Mukunda closer and closer to knowing God, that this lesson is so critical. And it brings us back to balance and equanimity, which is, again, what Yogananda says to us, that Sri Yukteswar had his feet firmly planted on the ground, but his heart in the haven of heaven, that he's existing in two places. You cannot neglect the material world simply because you love God. You can't be completely up in the air. You have to love God through every moment and through every action. And, Seva was such a foundational part, and it's no surprise that it's a foundational part of Yogananda's path and then Swami Kriyananda's path, and it just keeps getting passed back to Sri Yukteswar, who was grounded in seva, in action, in the ability to true nishkan karma, doing everything without the desire for the fruit of doing labor without the desire for the rewards. I'm not saying that right. What is the actual definition? The fruit of your labor, that's the word I was looking for. There are all these little stories about Sri Yukteswar when the disciples forgot to clean something up or wash his clothes. He would just do it quietly and silently. And it had nothing other to do other than with that reality that you have to work in the material plane, just like the story about the doctors that we were talking about earlier, that doctors are healing through material channels. And though we use our mind and our consciousness, we also heal on the material plane. We have to take care of the world here. And he never neglected that. At the end of chapter 12, which is the chapter where most of these stories come from, I highly recommend that you go home and reread it again. It talks about how Sri Yukteswar, many times he was taken to court because people wanted his property. They wanted to take, for various reasons, they wanted to take the property. It doesn't get into any of the nuances of why or how or what that meant. But it talks about how Sri Yukteswar went to court every time and fought, you know, with that intensity of a lion in order to keep the ashram. And he did this so that he would never have to be a begging sadhu, that he would always have the property and that people could come and live there for free and get training for free, that he didn't have to rely on appeasing or pleasing disciples in order to get donations from them, which again, you know, Yogananda mentions, and we'll talk a little bit about discipline after a break when we come back. Yogananda mentions that one of the freedoms that allotted him was to be the stern disciple or teacher that he was, because if he had to worry about appeasing his donors, then he would have to act differently. And so, but that ability to take care of the material world first was something that he wanted Yogananda to learn. And that's where we'll end, or we'll go to our break with this. Of course, we all know the story of receiving samadhi for the first time, cosmic consciousness. And at the end of that, what Sri Yukteswar says to him is, I'll paraphrase it, don't get lost or don't get drunk in the ecstasy in this moment. There's still much work to do. And then he hands him a room and says, come, let us sweep the balcony floor. And it's such a poignant moment for Yogananda. Along with this, you know, we think it's just the cauliflower robbery and we can laugh and joke, but that laugh, as I was reading it, it just, I felt that joy in that yoga that Sri Yukteswar was feeling in bringing his disciple closer and closer to God through the reality that you are here to bring thousands of souls, millions of souls perhaps, to God, and that your work is never done. You must be firmly rooted here in this material world. You have to make the material world work. And that this was even more important for Yogananda, who was being sent to the West. This is why he made Yogananda go to college and make sure that he had a degree, and taught him how to really interact with his devotees in the appropriate way, because all of these pieces combined to create the exact circumstances that were needed in order for Yogananda to go on to create SRF and ultimately for Swami to become his disciple and create Ananda and what we have here. I think we'll take a little break. How does that sound? Are there any thoughts, comments, questions? Anything that anybody wants to share? All right, let's just take, it's, what is it, 8:30? Let's just take a few minutes, 5 or 10 minutes, grab some tea. I'm going to fill up some water, and then we'll come back and just spend a few more minutes together. It is being taped, but I think it's just going to be taped. It's okay. Do I just push it once?
No.
No.
I'll show you. I'll do that.
I won't do anything.
You do this pause.
Oh. Perfect. Okay. I just have a few more stories that we can talk about, and then just anything else that you guys want to share. We hit a lot on the first two, but I wanted to share a few stories that specifically talk about discipline and humility in yoga in Sri Yukteswar. Obviously, we all know that Sri Yukteswar is known for the discipline and the sternness with which he spoke to his disciples. He actually says to Yogananda in this chapter 12, which I, again, the one I keep referencing the most, he says, I'm going to paraphrase, but he says, I am stern and honest and I have complete candor with my disciples, and I'm unapologetic in that, and I will never change that. But then he says, you will be different with your disciples. And so again, bringing in that bhakti spirit and referencing that, he says, you will be much kinder. Then he goes on and he says that both paths, the path of love and transmitting love and devotion, and the path of sternness and discipline, both paths have the ability to bring us to God realization when they are rooted in wisdom. And I just think that that's so profound, that it's the truth that no matter what we are offered, if it's rooted in wisdom, whatever way it comes to us, that it's there because it's bringing us home, it's bringing us back to that place of truth. And I was just speaking with someone over in the teaching center before this started, because of course whenever you say or mention, I was just picking up this little guy, whenever you mention Sri Yukteswar, it's, oh yeah, he's so stern and all these things, and I always love saying, oh no, he's just a bhakti and from the heart. And we were talking about it, and this person was saying to me, I need that sternness. I love that sternness. You know, as she was saying, I read Yogananda because it's don't stop. Whatever you're doing, just stop. Not don't stop. Just stop. Just change directions completely. And there's no wiggle room. And I was saying, I'm the exact opposite. I want someone to say, oh, come here. Let me hug you. You know, and just but that reality that no matter what path is ours, and we need a little bit of both. We, as a disciple, this is where he was speaking about the teacher transmitting to the disciple, so not necessarily what the disciple needs from within, but what the guru is transmitting to the disciple, whether it's love or whether it's sternness. If it's rooted in God realization, then it's bringing us home. It's bringing us back to that place, just like the jovial laugh, that belly laugh that comes at the end of the cauliflower robbery. Everything that laugh represents for us, whatever it is, whatever veils of delusion we have, let them be pushed aside so that we know we're headed home. And that was, see, now the story, the mosquito story. I remember why I was telling it now. See, it came back. And that's so at the end of that mosquito story, after he says, you rid yourself of mosquito consciousness, he's talking about that all, he says, all creatures have the right and the freedom to breathe, have the right to breathe the free air of Maya. And so that, again, that's what he's saying, change yourself, right? That's what he says, change yourself, rid yourself of mosquito consciousness, the world will not change for you. All creatures have the right to breathe the free air of Maya. And I think that is so poignant, because he doesn't just say the free air of this earth, he says the free air of Maya. Maya is always there, ready to swoop in. Just like he says to Mukunda in his first meetings, if ever I fall from God realization, put my head in your lap, and remind me of the beloved that we both worship. He was so humble, and humility and discipline really go together here, because the two are intertwined. The discipline and the strictness is in order to remain humble, in order to know that in any moment, Maya can swoop in for us. And it's such an important lesson. And even for Sri Yukteswar to stand back and to hold that humility and to hold that knowing is such an important and poignant lesson for each of us to feel. And it translates also into some of the day-to-day and the material things of his life. A very sweet story that Yogananda tells is that he was watching. So, as I said, Yukteswar lost his father. I don't think I said this. He lost his father very young. He lost his wife very early in the marriage, and he lost his daughter very young. But his mother was alive, and Sri Yukteswar, she was alive when Mukunda was at the ashram. And one day, Mukunda was watching. They were at her house in Benares, and Mukunda was watching their interactions, and he saw her kind of shaking her finger at him and not scolding him necessarily, but just being a mother. And she said, no, what Mukunda heard is, no, don't you do that, don't you tell me what to do, I am not one of your disciples. And Yukteswar just kind of nods and walks away, and Mukunda is struck by the humility there, and that realization that it's a moment of loving her, because to her, and this is what Yogananda references in the AY, says to her, Sri Yukteswar wasn't the self-realized avatar, he was her little boy. And to have all of the humility to know that, to not have to stand up and be proud and be, well, do you know who I am? And not that any of our avatars would do that, because they're avatars and they know. But there was no pride involved in his relationship with that God realization, with that divine consciousness. And in a moment, he could turn back and he could sort of pull that away with his mother in that moment in order to love her and honor the relationship that she saw when she stood in front of him. And this is a trend that we saw throughout, or that Mukunda, at this point, Yogananda, references seeing over and over again. Yukteswar, there are several miracles that are referenced. The cobra is one of them. They're eating dinner, or they're sitting at the table eating dinner, and a cobra comes and starts to, its hood is up, and it's slithering toward them, and Yukteswar starts clapping, right, which is the opposite. I didn't know this. I learned this in the book. But then I guess when you encounter a cobra, you want to be very still, because they'll strike at anything that's moving. And so he starts clapping, and his disciple, who is not Mukunda, but another disciple, gets very frightened for Sri Yukteswar and automatically starts praying for him. But the cobra just looks at Sri Yukteswar, goes in between his chair, and slithers away. And the story that this disciple recounts is that he knew in that moment that the creature, that his guru, that Sri Yukteswar, had no fear of any living creature. Why did he have no fear of any living creature? Because everything is God, and everything is a part of that, and he has that humility. It's the same stories that we hear with Yogananda and the tigers, or Yogananda and the robbers, the men that were trying to rob him, and then they just fall open-hearted and say, what are you doing to me? In the midst of that, because when we are, it's the yamas and niyamas, when we are perfected in that, that yama, nothing can harm us, because we are interacting with the world in that exchange. And this is complete humility, because it takes egolessness in order to be in that exchange. We are so aware of our separateness, and we are so aware of all the things that can attack us. That's why I can sit here and say to you, I'm scared of ticks. I'm probably scared that they're in this room right now. But if I'm not, right, if I can let go of that realization, if I can be one with the divine, then nothing can harm me, because everything is a part of God and it's flowing through us. And if we're not there, then we can at least try and be Hanuman, who is the perfect disciple, who says, yes, anything you give me, divine one, I take it, right? And so if we're not at that God realization where nothing can harm us, then let us at least stay open-hearted and accept anything that comes to us. And a story that reminded me of this a few weeks ago, about a month ago now, I was up in Washington on Camino Island, which many of you know is Zach and Haley, two young friends that I have up there. And Zach, he grafts trees. And so one day we went out and we planted 25 trees. So we were digging holes the day before, and then luckily it rained that night. So the next day we went out and we were putting the trees into the ground. And when we dug the holes, we were digging with shovels. And there were tons of blackberries and tons of stinging nettles up there. And so when you're using the shovel, you have no danger, no fear of any of that, because there's a distance between you and the soil. But planting, we had to put the soil back into the ground. And Zach said, "I don't use gloves. Do you want gloves?" And of course, I was like, "No, I don't want gloves." And so we went out there, and we just our hands were just completely covered with blackberries and the stinging nettles. They last for about 24 hours, for some people longer. And we were just having so much fun and being like, "Ow, this hurts. This is fantastic." And he said at one point, because there was another woman with us who was, she kept saying, "I can't believe you're not using gloves." And he said, "Lakshmi, do you want a pair of gloves?" And I said, "No, you know what, it actually keeps you aware, because we were going into that and I was feeling like complete ownership, not ownership, but just that there was complete ownership over that soil. It will go where I want it to go. It will do what I need it to do because I'm bigger and stronger and more intelligent than it. But then you stick your hands in there and you're getting poked and stung and all of these things." And as I said, "I love this, because it's that realization that you have no control over anything, that you are a part of something so much bigger. And the moment you think you have control over it, it's going to get you, right? Just like Maya, all creatures have the right to breathe the free air of Maya." And so it was such a reassuring realization that humility, that practice of humility in every moment, is so essential to our path. Gratitude and humility, the longer that I'm on this path, but I have light years to go still. But every day I'm realizing more and more, and the more time that I spend with, if it brings us all the way kind of full circle back to where we started, the more time that you spend with these gurus, you realize that humility and gratitude, that practice of just offering everything that you are back into the divine, is the essential practice. That is living with God in motion. That is living true karma yoga. That was an interesting, you know, Priman, on May 10th, so just a few weeks ago, Priman sent out an email, a letter about Sri Yukteswar, which I can send to any of you if you want to see it. And he was referencing not this biography, but another one that must be very similar to this, because it was the same stories. And, oh, see, there goes the thought again.
Humility.
Humility, yeah. Yeah, it'll come back. Yeah, it'll come back. It'll come back when it wants to, or it won't. And that will also be fine. But if we just come back to, so if I pull that other thread, humility, and just the importance of, it's all lost. The importance of living every moment. I'm just going to re-say what I just said, so hopefully it will all come back. But that reality that when we are living every moment with this exchange of gratitude, when we're offering ourselves, that's what I was saying, see? In this letter that Freeman wrote, so he was referencing a lot of the stories that we share today and then just expounding upon them with his own thoughts a little bit. And one of the things that he said is, it was very interesting, Sri Yukteswar tried to start another organization that didn't work. He tried to write another book before the Holy Science about the Gita, a commentary on the Gitas, that never got any grounding. And what Freeman was noting was that karma yoga, right? Karma yoga was an essential part of his spiritual practice, that he was constantly practicing seva, but that karma yoga was not his path. Therefore, that output of energy wasn't getting the exchange back because it wasn't his particular path. And if I say, I was just saying to you guys, I feel like I'm learning that I'm a bhakti, but I definitely know I'm a karma yogi, and therefore that there's that exchange that happens there. It was just an interesting, I'd never thought about it that way, and again, those are Freeman's thoughts on it, but that never stopped Sri Yukteswar from always offering himself back in every moment into selfless service. That's one of the things that Sri Yukteswar himself, let me see if I can find it quickly, he sort of chastised wealthy, and not wealthy, so I won't look for it, so I won't think. He always chastised sadhus who were very regal and sort of standing up and being prideful and look at how great and divine I am, or any sadhus or who had ashrams that were extremely lavish and over the top, because simplicity was such an essential part of his path and his teachings and what he brought. to Yogananda and then brought and continued on to us. And he said at one point that he didn't want to be referred to as a religious man, that he was a servant to all. That's the word that I was looking for. And that's how Sri Yukteswar defined himself. And Yogananda mentioned so many times in here that it didn't matter what caste, what gender, where a person came from, if they were coming with a sincerity of heart that Yogananda gave them, I'm sorry, that Sri Yukteswar gave them, gave that person his full attention, all of his love, all of his devotion. And so that, you know, again, just bringing all of these pieces together, balance and equilibrium, that impartiality, that those who are rooted in God and the desire to know God, that was the kinship that Sri Yukteswar felt. And I just thought that's so beautiful, a servant to all. It's such a beautiful way for us to carry ourselves as we go through the world, that whomever is in front of us, and we all have busy, crazy lives, and you get home and, you know, you're running up to your apartment and someone says, oh, hi, how can I talk to you for a minute? And you're like, ah, yes. You know, and it's just, I'm a servant to all. Where am I right now? Here I am in this moment. If this person in front of me is sincere, they're seeking God, can I give them everything that I have? These are the lessons that Yogananda teaches, that Sri Yukteswar and Yogananda teach us. And so I'll just tell one more story about discipline. Why not end there? And so this is a story. This is, I many of you may know it, but I had forgotten about it until I reread it. But when he's in the ashram, when Mukunda is in the ashram, another young man named Kumar comes to live in the ashram. And Kumar quickly becomes Sri Yukteswar's favorite, which is such an interesting thing to think about. Yogananda's response, a little bit of a tangent, but we have the time, so I'll take it. Yogananda's response to that is that he says, paraphrasing, he says, I didn't care that the idiosyncrasies of characteristics and of personality and attraction make life interesting. So what he was saying is he didn't feel saddened in his heart that his guru had a clear favorite, that that Kumar was just someone he doted on, because the idiosyncrasies of attraction makes the patterns of life more interesting, which is such, I mean, that's where we all want to be, right? There's no titta, there's no heart involved in that at all. It's just, wow, we're all so different, how fascinating. And wow, you're attracted to that, how fascinating. There was nothing in him. And Yogananda goes on, this is all in chapter 12 of the AY, to say, I was seeking something much more important than acceptance and approval, verbal approval from my guru. I was referencing God realization, that what he wanted was cosmic consciousness. But Kumar quickly becomes Sri Yukteswar's favorite, and within a month of being at the ashram, he's given Sri Yukteswar, Yogananda's job, which was the manager of the ashram. He was working in the kitchen. So Yukteswar comes in one day and says, Mukunda, trade jobs with Kumar. And then Kumar, he bristles up. He sort of becomes much bigger and proud of the job that he has and everything, that the opportunities he's been given. But all of the other disciples in the ashram keep going to Yogananda for advice. So Kumar goes to Yukteswar and complains and says, oh, you know, Mukunda is taking all of the, you gave me the responsibility of ashram manager, but they're also going to Mukunda. And Sri Yukteswar scolds Kumar, and this is the first time it's significant because it's the first time that Yogananda has seen Sri Yukteswar scold Kumar. And he scolds him and says, you wanted this job, but you don't have the merits to hold on to it. And he automatically gives Yogananda back his job. And then he goes on to explain that a few months later, Kumar wanted to go home and spend a little bit of time at home. And he was very careful not to forbid him from doing it, but made it known, this is Yukteswar, made it known that he did not want Kumar leaving. And Kumar left anyway. And when he comes back, he's completely different, and he's changed, and he's just been—he's drenching in sense pleasures, and so much so that Sri Yukteswar says he needs to leave the ashram, that he can't stay, he's not suited for monastic life anymore. And he asks Yogananda to ask him to leave, and he has tears in his eyes. He says, "I can't do it." And he goes on to say, "If he hadn't left, if he'd listened to me, this never would have happened." And so it just brings us back to that reality of discipline, of sternness, that what we are doing here, again, Maya can slip in, it can trap us in any moment. And the heart is present in all of that. And if we know what our guru is asking us to do, we know what our Param Guru is asking us to do. And when we can stay steadfast in those techniques, when we can stay steadfast in the teachings and always bring ourselves back to them, then we don't have to fear losing track. We don't have to fear, right? This is what Yogananda says. To those who think me near, what is it? If you are in tune, right? And what he says to us, if you are in tune, my devotee is never lost. And the other thing he says that if, what is it? If you are in tune to, I'm losing it now. Essentially, I'll paraphrase it. Essentially, he says that a devotee can fall in any moment, but if you stay in tune, it need not be so. And so, I guess that, you know, kind of wrapping us up and bringing us back to the end, the life of Sri Yukteswar is a constant example of the ways in which this discipline, this steadfast desire to put God first, to know from the inside out. I think that's the quote that I would leave you with, that we can't know things, it's the fourth time I'm saying it, but we can't know something with our eyes, we have to know it with our atoms. In the Holy Science, he talks about everything in creation being spiritualized atoms. It's so impersonal, it's amazing just how unattached and impersonal this great avatar is in the way that he's speaking. And he talks about spiritualized atoms and they have desires and, oh, there's chitta, now it's going this way and that, but it's everything is just a spiritualized atom. And when we can infuse those atoms with God consciousness, I guess what I should say is when we can awaken to the reality that they are already infused with God consciousness, that they are God, then we are moving closer and closer to that oneness. And everything that Sri Yukteswar, I wish I could just sit here and read this chapter to you. It is dripping with wisdom and so many quotes that we hear from Sri Yukteswar over and over again that just talk about that reality. Put God first, that God is simple, the rest is complex. That's not Sri Yukteswar, but it's the essence of how he lived his life. So that he can say at the end of giving his disciple cosmic consciousness, there's still much work to do. Come, let us sweep the balcony floor. Then we'll take a walk by the Ganges. It's so simple. God is so simple, and Sri Yukteswar is the perfect example of that. Over and over again, we see it.